Mr. Tom Dodd reading an extract from Betsy Lee by D.E. Brown.
Now, most of you lads has had a spell of courting and that. And it's hard to tell how ever a youngster comes to fancy that of all the girls it's Ginny or Nancy or Mary or Betsy that must be his'n. I don't know how it is that it isn't, but some time or other it comes to us all, just like a clap of shoot or a squall or a snake or a viper or some such dirt creeping under your shirt and sliding and slipping right into your breast and making you as you can't get rest. And it works till you feel your heart raising. God knows what it is if it isn't poison. You see, we are a roughish set of chaps that's brought up rough on our mammy's laps. And we grow and we run about shouting and fooling till we gets to be lumps and fit for the schooling. Then we gets to know the marks and the signs and we leaves the school and we sticks to the lines, baiting and setting and hauling and that, till we know every fish from a quail to a sprat. And we gets big and strong, for do make you stronger to row a big boat and to pull at a conger. Then what with a cobbling up of the yawl and a patching and mending the nets for the trawl, and a rising early and a going to bed late, and a dreaming of scallops as big as a plate, and the hooks and the creels and the oars and the gut, you'd say there's no room for a little slut. But howsomever, it's not the case, and a pretty face is a pretty face, and through the whole kyle, as bright as a star, a gell slips in, and there you are. Well, that was just the way with me and the gell I'm speaking of, Betsy Lee. Ah, mates, it's wonderful too, the years you may live dead on end with your eyes and your ears right alongside of the lass that's going to be your sweetheart, and you never known. That's the way, for her father and mine was neighbours, and both in the fisherman line, and their cottages stood on the open beach with a nice bit of garden aback of them each. You know the way them houses is fixed, with the pigs and the hens and the childer mixed, and the mothers go round when the nights begin and quips up their own and takes them in. Her father was terrible fond of flowers, and his garden was twice as handsome as ours. A mortal keen eye he had for the varmin, and his talk was always of plantin' and farmin'. He had roses hanging above his door, uncommon fine roses they was to be sure, and the joy of me heart was to pull them there and break them in pieces on Betsy's hair. Not that Betsy was much of a size at the time, I mean, but she had big eyes, so big and so blue and so far asunder, and she looked so solemn I used to wonder. That was all, just baby play, knocking about the boats all day, and sometimes a lot of us taking hands and racing like mad things over the sands. It wouldn't have been bad for some of us if we'd never gone further and never feared was, if we'd never grown up and never got big, if we'd never took the brandy swig, if we were skipping and scampering and capering still on the sand that lies below the hill, crunching its grey ribs with the beat of our little pattering naked feet, if we just kept childer upon the shore for ever and ever and ever more. Now the beauty of the ting when the childer plays is, the terrible wonderful length the days is, up your jumps and out in the sun, and you fancy the day will never be done. And you're chasing the bumbies humming so cross in the hot sweet air among the grass, or gathering bluebells, or looking for eggs, or pelting the ducks with their yellow legs, or a climbing and nearly breaking your skulls, or a shouting for devilment after the gulls, or a thinking of nothing but down at the tide, singing out for the happy you feel inside. That's the way with the kids, you know, and the years do come, and the years do go, and when you look back, it's all like a puff, happy, and over, and shorted up. Well, I never took notions on Betsy Lee, nor no more did she, I suppose, on me, till one day digging upon the sand, Gibbons, of course you'll understand, a lad that was always a cheeky young sprout, began a pulling the Betsy about, and he worried the wench till her shoulders were bare, and he slipped the knot of her beautiful hair, and down it come, as you may say, just like a shower of golden spray, blown this way and that by a gamesome breeze, and the rip, rip, rippling down to her knees. I looked at Betsy. Oh dear, how she stood, a quivering all over, and her face like blood, and her eyes all wet with tears like fire, and her breast a swelling higher and higher, and she gripped her sickle with a twitchy feel, and her thumbs started out like a kyle of steel, and a cloud seemed to pass from me eyes, and the glory like them you'll see painted sometimes in a story, breathed out from her skin, and I saw her no more the child I had always thought her before, but wrapped in the glory and wrapped in the hair, every inch of a woman stood panting there. So I ups with me fists as I was bound, and won for his knob and knocks him down. But from that day, by land and sea, I loved her, oh, I loved her, my Betsy Lee.
The story goes that a certain old Manx local preacher, on one occasion, entered the pulpit without having prepared his sermon, and he chose his text at random. And he came across that passage where it reads, "Awake, harp, lute, and psaltery. I myself will arise right early." His rendering was, "Awake, harp, lute, and psaltery. I myself will arise right early." Now, my dear friends assembled here this pleasant Sabbath morning, I have no doubt but what many of you is well acquaint with the words of my text, but whether you have got its inner meaning, the hidden meaning, I cannot say, but I will try to elucidate it this morning. The harp, of course, there's not much need for me to explain that. We've all seen these fellas going about twanging harps, at least they used to be when I was a young fella. In the streets they'd be playing harps, big, big harps outside the houses and collecting money for it. And maybe most of us here this morning, when we've finished our earthly career, we'll have a harp apiece in the celestial regions. I'm hoping so anyway. But the second thing which is mentioned here maybe requires more explanation. Lute. Now, maybe some of you know that in the old days, nation was warring against nation just as they have been all the years since. And out there, where old David and all these others was living, one sect would be fighting against another sect, and maybe a city would be beleaguered by the enemy, and the ones outside would be striving hard to get in, and the ones inside would be doing their best to keep the besiegers out. But in the end, maybe the city would fall, and the besiegers would rush in and put the men and women and children to the sword. And what would they take away with them? Loot. Now the third thing which is mentioned here, the Pazar tree, is a tree which doesn't grow in this country at all. But away there where old David was living, there was big forests full of these here Pazar trees, and the birds of the ear would be nesting under the hanging boughs. On the bases of the field would be taking shelter there from the storms that might be arising. And David, my friends, had one of these Pazar trees, a little one, grown underneath the bedroom window in his palace. And one night, when he was just going up to bed, he heard the winds beginning to blow most tempestuous. And he went to the barometer in the hall and he gave it a tap and he said, "My God," he said, "there'll be some deal done tonight." Off he went to bed. And when he was in bed a little while, the winds increased with far more velocity than they had been previously. And he heard a crash outside, and he jumped up, and he looked out through the veiny Venetians, and there he seen that the little Pazar tree had been uprooted and cast down on the ground. "And David, my friends," he said, "never mind, little tree," he said, "I will arise right early," meaning that in the morning he would try to get it put into its our position again. So, brethren, David went to bed and slept the sleep of the just. And in the morning, when he woke, he remembered what he had said the night before, "I will arise right early." He weren't like a lot of the ones I'm looking at in this chapel this morning, who is mighty swibber with promises the night before, and when the morning comes, another turn or two in the bed like the sluggard. No, my friends, David wasn't like that. With one mighty bound, he leapt from his bed and round to the cowhouse at the back, and he got a grape there, and he got one or two men, and down with them to the little tree, and worked at it, and got it put into its old position again. And my friends, aren't we like that little tree? Don't the storms and temptations of life often come beating down upon us with such force that in spite of all we can do, we are overpowered and cast to the ground? But if we could go to the right source, once more, like David's little tree, we will be standing upright, firm, immovable, and immune from all the shocks that can assail us.
What about that old woman who was married several times?
Oh, yes, I remember the old dame now that you reminded me of. I knew her well when I was comparatively young. She'd been married four times, as a matter of fact, and unlike the modern habit, she buried all her husbands. She didn't bother to separate from them in the ordinary way, as it's known today. But after the death of her third husband, she wasn't very old at that time. Number four came along, and he was a good deal older than she was. And someone said to her one day, "It's a wonder, Mrs. So-and-so, that you're going to marry an old man like that." "Yeah." "Well, yes," she said, "the years is on the man right enough, but there's a bit of wear in him yet." I remember the first time that I came in contact with her, I was walking on the shore where she kept a little refreshment hut with my uncle, and he said to her, "It's a wonder," he said, "you're not getting married again, Mrs. So-and-so," laughingly, of course. And she said, "Oh, no, no, Master East," she said, That would never do, he said. They'd be having me up for manslaughter. And I remember on another occasion having come from Douglas with a number of young people, and we were on the beach, we were having tea at the old lady's refreshment room, and she remarked to one of the girls, "Are you married yet?" "No," says the girl, "not yet." "Oh, well," says the old lady, "there's nothing in it anyway. I've had four myself, and what matter for it am I?"
Can you tell us the tale of the weaver's beam?
Oh, the weaver's beam, yes, I remember. I remember the late Caesar Cashin telling the story of the weaver's beam. The old pither, that's what the Manx people called the weaver, lived out in on the road to Glenrushen, the road going off Glenmay, you know, out to Glenrushen. And he was very friendly with the king of the fairies in that district. In those days, if you don't happen to know it, there were many fairies in the Isle of Man, and they didn't all belong to the same coterie. There were various classes and or various tribes, and they were quite friendly, and they were in the habit of visiting one another. So one night the weaver was sitting by his fireside, and there was a knock at the door, and when he answered it, there was the king of the fairies seated on a big white horse, and behind him all the other fairies on horseback too. So the king said to the weaver, "Come on," he said, "we're going down to Kirkmickle to visit the fairies there tonight." And the weaver said, "I can't go," he said. I haven't got a horse," he said. "Oh, don't talk like that," says the weaver, says the king of the fairies to him. "Fetch your weaver's beam out," he said. "And what for?" says the old weaver. "That's dreadful heavy." "Never mind the for," he said. "You fetch it out here." So the weaver brought the beam out. "Now cock your leg over that," says the king to him. And as soon as he did that, lo and behold, he was on as good a horse as any of them. And off they set them for Kirkmickle, down through Glenmay, past Patrick, into Peel, and along the shore road from Peel in the direction of Kirkmickle. And when they got to the Glen Kem, you know that place where it makes a big circle round, the weaver was astounded to see all the horses in front of him with their riders jump clean across the chasm instead of going round, and he wondered what on earth was going to happen to him. And when he got up to the chasm, bless me if his horse didn't jump it as well as any of them. And the weaver was so astounded that he ejaculated, "May ye Cren Lian San Beamel." My God, what a jump for a beam. And by using the sacred name, the spell was broken, and there he was at Lian Kem, several miles away from Glenrushen, astride of a big balk of timber. Among the stories of the preachers is one told me by an old Manxman, himself a regular chapel goer, that the regular attender at one of the country chapels was a great critic of the local preachers. They apparently never reached his standard, and a frequent remark of his was that he would have done better himself. On one occasion the preacher didn't turn up, and the officials invited the critic to take his place. "He went into the pulpit," said my informant, "and give out the hymn." "Yes," he managed to read a hymn, "and then he repeated the Lord's Prayer. He give out another hymn and read the lesson. These things he did tolerably well. And then came the time for the sermon, and the congregation settled itself to listen. Oh, and he had a text too. Oh, yes, and he read it out, then stopped and looked all round the chapel. He read it a second time, and again he looked all round. And he read it a third time, and there was a pause while he looked all round again. Then he looked up and exclaimed, O God, thou art a middling owl God, and a middling wise God. But thou'll be twice as owl and twice as wise before thou'll ever see me up here again. We had a great number at one time of rhymesters in the Isle of Man, whose reputation extended over the whole of our island. And one of these old Manxmen, when walking along the Starby Road on one occasion, called in the old public house, the Tiger, which was situated at the top of the by road running down by Ebenezer to the Glen Helen Road. There were already several men in the Tiger, among them an old hunchback. Naturally, they wished to know who the newcomer, a stranger to those parts, was. And the answer that he was Thomas Shimon of Kirkrushen conveyed nothing to them. Pressed further, he said, Have you ever heard of Tom the Dipper, then? And are you Tom the Dipper, the man who makes up the rhymes, they shouted. I am, says Tom. You couldn't make up a rhyme about me, sneered the old hunchback. Tom said nothing in reply at the time, but as he was leaving, with one foot outside the door, he delivered these lines. Thou hunchbacked soul, thy face is pale with drinking of the tiger's ale, and drinking all the long day round will bring thy hunchback to the ground. We often hear that a Manxman will hardly ever give a direct yes or no in answer to a question, even one that plainly calls for such a reply. He is unwilling to be pinned down, doesn't want to give himself away, as it were. And some of them have an extraordinary faculty of escaping with colours flying from a situation in which they seemed hopelessly entangled. There is a story told of a celebrated character in Selby 30 years ago or more. He was the principal heckler at all the political meetings for miles round, and in those days heckling was a fine art. Among his other abilities, he could swallow huge quantities of beer, though he looked such a venerable old gentleman with his long whiskers. He often used to boast that no one had ever seen him drunk. No one has ever seen me drunk, Johnny would say. Then one evening, a light evening, two of the villagers on their way home found Johnny outside his own house, lying on the ground and most gloriously tight. Of course they went to help him up, and one of them said, Well, Mr. So-and-so, you'll never again be able to say that no one has ever seen you drunk. Johnny gave a little grunt. Holding himself together a bit, said, Boys are boys. I cannot tell rightly if it was a fit or a stroke that came over me.